Things on? Okay. It's a tremendous, it's a Yiddish word called Fagenigen, which doesn't really translate 100% into English. It means great pleasure, enjoyment, fun even, to be able to speak here. I've heard very much about this yeshiva, and my old chaver from Atlanta, Rav Kalman Rosenbaum, who you're zeichet to have as a manal here, asked me to speak, and for me it's a tremendous fagenigen to be able to speak to the yeshiva and to be able to speak in front of Rav Kalman. It's interesting, to my mind, that there are certain halachas that the Torah tells us that are very prevalent, very important halachas, and they're seminal halachas, essential halachas, but yet the Torah only hints at them. Or sometimes says one pasuk, like for example, the din of roiv. All of Klal Yisrael, every halacha kimat, is based on the dinim of roiv, the majority. And yet the Torah tells us one small pasuk about roiv, acher rabim lahatos that you have in Parshas Mishpatim. But yet some halachas that seem to be more archaic, the Torah spends a tremendous amount of time speaking about. This week's parsha and last week's parsha and the next several weeks' parsha. Parshiyos, a good portion of the Parshiyos talks about the Mishkan and the Kelim and about the big day Kayin Gadol and even about the counting of the money that was given, the donations that were given for the Mishkan and for the big day Kahuna. It's about five Parshiyos long. And then right afterwards, we go into Vayikra that talks about Kabbonos, which the Torah speaks about in great detail. I venture to say that there isn't any mitzvah in the entire Torah that's talked about more at length than the building of the Mishkan or about the Kabbanos. I venture to say that. And you have to wonder a little bit why that is, why the Torah spends so much time on the Mishkan and on the Kelim and on the Big Day Kahuna. I think that the Mishkan teaches us a tremendous lesson. Today, for all generations of Klal Yisrael, including modern times, there's a tremendous ability of Klal Yisrael, of Yidden and Klal Yisrael, to be able to transform situations. Let me illustrate. It's a very famous Gemara that I'm sure all of you B'nai Torah know, that Gemara tells us that Rabbi Kiva and his chaverim, his colleagues, were walking after the destruction of the second base of Mikdash, after the Churban Bayis Sheni. They were walking and they came across the Churban Bayis Sheni. And the Tanayim began to cry. They looked at the Churban Bayis and began to cry. Rabbi Akiva looks at the Churban Bayis and he begins to laugh. So they looked at him and they said, Rabbi Akiva, why are you laughing for? So he turns it back on them. He says, why are you crying? Now, that's not much of a question, because anybody who sees, has ever gone to the Kaisel, who has a little bit of a gefil, a little bit of a heart, some emotion, goes to the Kaisel and begins to cry. So Kolshkein, Rabbi Akiva, and the great Tanayim, they're standing there and they see the Churban Bayis, and there's no plaza built up, and there's nothing there, and there's animals walking there, and of course they cry. But Rabbi Akiva asked them, why do you cry? So they say, we cry, obviously, because we see the Churban Bayis, but why do you laugh? So Rabbi Akiva says, the same nevuah, the same prophecy that HaKadosh Baruch Hu told us that the Beis HaMikdash is going to be destroyed, that same nevuah HaKadosh Baruch Hu said that one day the Beis HaMikdash is going to be rebuilt. You cry because you see the Beis HaMikdash being destroyed. I laugh because I see the Beis HaMikdash being rebuilt. That's a wonderful Gemara, but you have to ask yourself a question, I think. That why didn't Rabbi Akiva first cry and then laugh? Just laughing alone doesn't sound like it's the right response. Doesn't sound like the right emotion. He should have seen the Churban Bayis and cried. And then afterwards crying, he should have laughed. And then they would have asked him, why are you crying and then laughing? In which he would have responded this answer. I cry because of the Churban Bayis, which is my natural response, but I laugh because I know that the Beis HaMikdash is going to be rebuilt. Rabbi Akiva didn't cry at all. He only laughed. I think that Rabbi Akiva only cried and then laughed. I don't think it would have been recorded in the Gemara. I don't think it's a great big deal for people to go to the Churban Bayis and cry. Everybody does it. And to cry and then to laugh, I think would have been missing the point. I think Rabbi Akiva's laughter is an essential part of the mindset of a Yid and Klal Yisrael, and the Gemara recorded it for a lesson for us. And this is what I mean to say. Klal Yisrael has had a tremendous ability to transform situations. All of you here have an ability to transform situations. Friday night, we ate a meal. Either you ate in yeshiva, or you ate by some younger man, or younger light went home and they ate. I could tell you exactly what was on the menu. I could tell you what was on the menu of every single house in Klal Yisrael, and Eretz Yisrael, in America, in Europe, all over. It was the same thing. You started off with some fish, and you had some soup, and then you went into some chicken, and you had some rice, and you had some kugel, and you had a dessert. That's basically the meal. Same meal every single week. But you know what? You didn't eat a piece of fish. You didn't do that. You ate a Shabbos meal. You didn't eat a piece of chicken. You ate a Shabbos meal. You weren't just eating a meal. It was a Shabbos meal. It was an Einik Shabbos. It was a transformation. We eat during the entire week. And Goyim eat also. Everyone eats. But when we eat on Shabbos, we're not just stam eating a meal. We're eating a Suda Shabbos. It's a whole different paradigm. It's a whole different dynamic. It's something else. We, in Klal Yisrael, have the ability to transform something into something much greater than what it is. We have the Kedusha of something, and we bring it out in full, vivid color, and that's what we are in Klal Yisrael. Rabbi Akiva took a look at the Beis HaMikdash, and he saw the same Churban that everybody else saw. But in his mind, he was able to transform that Churban, not into a Churban, but into a rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash many, many years later. He didn't see the Churban like we see the Churban. He saw the transformation of the Beis HaMikdash. A tremendous lesson to Klal Yisrael. We need to see the transformation. I want to share with you a story that made a great impression upon me. I think it was told by Reb Shlomo Hyman. For those of you who have never heard of Shlomo Hyman, he was the Rosh Yeshiva of Torah Vadas. He was a Europeish. He was I think he was a Talmud of Reb Chaim Oizer, if I'm not mistaken. And he came to America, and he became the Rosh Yeshiva of Torah Vadas. Now, Shlomo Hyman was a great Talmud Chacham, but he also happened to have been a very elegant and very eloquent public speaker. And in the 20s and 30s and early 40s in America, there were very few like him who were major Talmidei Chachamim, tremendous Masmidim, heads of yeshivas, and also were renowned public speakers. So of course, every organization that had anything to do with anything from in Klal Yisrael wanted Reb Shlomo Hyman to be the public speaker, the keynote speaker. And one day, he was asked to speak at a particular organization's function, Riverside Plaza, which is, I think, in the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And he accepted. And when it came the day to speak, there was a tremendous snowstorm in New York, the likes of which Yerushalayim never experiences. Feet and feet of snow, and it crippled the city that was very well used to snow. And the buses stopped running, and some of the trains stopped running, and certainly there were no taxis, there was no way to drive, and this dinner was going to be an absolute disaster because nobody was going to come. So the Masadra of the dinner, of course, goes to Riverside Plaza, and he's there early, gets there, and he figures that nobody's going to show up. And about an hour before the dinner starts, in walks Reb Shlomo Hyman, shivering, absolutely freezing, shaking the snow off of himself, could barely stand to talk, and the fellow gives him, the Masada gives him a cup of tea, sits him down, says, Rosh Hashiva, I didn't expect that you would be coming here. I didn't think at all that you would deign to come. It's snowing. We're not even going to have anybody here. Shlomo says, I made a commitment, and I need to come. It turns out that he walked from Yeshiva Torah Vadas early in the morning, and he walked all the way to the Upper West Side of Manhattan in order to fulfill his commitment to come. Well, the fellow who was in charge of the dinner was very embarrassed. He said, Rebbe, there isn't going to be anybody here at the dinner. Shlomo says, let's wait and see. So when it came time for the dinner to start, whatever the appointed hour was, the Masadu looks out, and he sees that three stragglers show up. There's a dinner which was set for about 600 or 700 people. Three people show up. So he looks out from behind the curtain. He sees these three people there. He turns to Shlomo and he says, Shlomo, I can't ask Rosh Yeshiva to speak. It's just a small... I just can't ask Rosh Yeshiva to speak. Let me see myself. He looks out and he says, what do you mean? The place is packed. So the Masada says, well, maybe Shlomo got affected because of the snow. It was a long walk. He looks out again. He sees three people. He says, Rebbe, I hate to tell you, but the people didn't come. They just didn't show up. So Shlomo looks out again. He says, I don't understand what you're saying. It's a packed olam. There was something wrong. Obviously, there's something wrong. So the Masada says, come, let's look together. He looks outside. He says, Rebbe, you see, there's one person there, there's another person there, there's another person over there, and that's it. Shlomo says, let me explain to you something. See, you see three people, I see thousands. You know what it's going to be if I speak? And I say something that will affect these three people. They'll go home, they'll tell their wives and husbands, they'll tell their children, they'll tell their friends, the children will tell their friends, they'll tell their grandchildren, it'll make an impression, when you see three people, I see thousands of people. And Reb Shlomo went and said the exact same speech that he would have spoken to an audience of 650, he said it to these three people. Reb Shlomo took those three people and transformed them into a Klal Yisrael. It's a unique ability of Klal Yisrael. When we're sitting in Golis, and we're sitting in the most deprived situations, we're able to transform our environment into a different situation altogether. I'll share with you something about myself. I live now in Hollywood, Florida. No, it's not Hollywood, California. Our motto is, all sun, no stars. That's what that's Hollywood, Florida. So I have a kale there. But I went to Hollywood. I came from Atlanta, and actually my first shtetl was in the Midwest, in Dayton, Ohio. I had the shtetl in the Midwest, and I was offered, and I went to my Rebbe of Shlomo Volbe, and I asked him whether I should take the shtetl or not, in Dayton, Ohio. And Dayton, Ohio is not exactly an Irvayim V'Yisrael of thousands of Jews. There were apartheid and even there, you know, 2,000-3,000 Jews in Dayton. But it was an opportunity, and he felt I should take it. My wife, when I came home and told her, did not believe me. She says, there's no way the Mashgiach said that. She insisted on going to speak to Mashgiach herself. Mashgiach should tell her herself that the family should uproot. We had four children at the time from Yerushalayim to move to Dayton, Ohio. And he told her, yes, you should go, you'll have Hatzlacha. And we taka went. To her credit, she followed the Mashgiach and went to Dayton, Ohio. We took our kids out of Beis Yaakov HaTzafon and put them into a day school, which I won't even describe. So, Al Kopanim, we were in Dayton, and it happened to be four rewarding years in the Midwest. Very rewarding, difficult, but rewarding years in the Midwest. I wouldn't have traded for anything. But I must tell you that it wasn't always easy. It wasn't always easy. Sometimes it was really very difficult. So one Friday night, I came to shul, and it was very snowy that night. And the shul was a reasonably sized shul, but it didn't get a minyan that night. I guess people didn't want to come out in the snow, and they just didn't come. So here I am, and there were literally four other people with me in shul, and I'm sitting there up front where the rabbi is supposed to sit, and I'm thinking to myself, why do I need this for? Why do I have to be in Dayton, Ohio, sitting here in a place without even a minyan to daven in? I mean, please, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, why did you put me here? And then I realized that this is a very, very poor attitude. When I was in Yerushalayim, I used to daven very often in the Kais. Not a particular minyan, I used to like to daven on a Friday night. And in my mind, I envisioned that I'm sitting there by the Kaisel in that place where I daven dozens upon dozens of times, and that's where I was. That's where I was. And I davened that davening, and in a chanami, I thought I was by the Kaisel, I thought I was davening there with all those Eden, and I was davening there with all those Eden. That's where I was, by the Kaisel, davening with that many Eden. It was a wonderful and a gewaltig and inspiring tefillah. I had a Rebbe. I don't know if you ever heard of him. His name was Menachem Yitzchok Frank. He lived here in Yerushalayim. I lived with him for a number of years. His uncle was a very well-known Rav. His name was Hersh Pesach Frank. It was P. Pesach Frank. And I learned from him by a number of years. Menachem Yitzchok was a goyna tzaddik. A goyna tzaddik. He knew kol Torah kula, mamish kol Torah kula. But I think, I'm not sure if he was a bigger Talmud Chacham than tzaddik, or was a bigger tzaddik than a Talmud Chacham. I don't know. He was a yid who, when he would say a bracha, he would say an asher yotzar, he would have to build up to it. He would chuckle. He'd be lost in thought. Then he'd say his asher yotzar, not loud. He'd say it, and he'd tremble when he was saying Hashem's name. Every bracha was like that. He was a yid, a tzaddik, a mamash tzaddik. He had an apartment, and when his wife was nifteres, he gave the apartment to his daughter, and he had a room in the back of the apartment. And he used to sit there, I think he lived on tea. That's what I think he lived on. He had a glazel of tea, and his sefer open, and when you came in, you talked to him in learning, and he stopped what he was doing, and he talked to you in learning, and when he finished, he went back to his whatever sefer he was learning, and his glazel of tea. That's what I think he lived on. If you would have asked Reb Nachum Yitzchok, what, you're living in a little small room, and you know, it wasn't particularly well furnished, and you didn't have much to eat, he would have laughed at you. For Reb Nachum Yitzchok, he had everything that he wanted in the world. He was living in a palace, he had choice foods, he had the best entertainment that he wanted, he was sitting there in front of a sefer. He had a joyous and a wonderful life. We, American Talmidim, wanted to pay him. He wouldn't take a penny from us, not because he didn't have he had a principal and take money. He didn't need anything. There was nothing that we could offer him that he could possibly need. He had everything that he wanted. He had his suit of clothing, he had his frock, and he had his shirt, he had his tie, and that's it. He had everything that he wanted. So what was there to offer him? He was a rich man. He took the world, and he took what he had, his environment, and he transformed it into a very, very special, very, very Kaddish Digger place. It's a tremendous lesson in the Mishkan. HaKadosh Baruch Hu said that I want you to build me a Mishkan. The Mishkan is a room, essentially, or a partitioned room with curtains. Later on, it became the Beis HaMikdash with a couple of rooms in the Beis HaMikdash. It was a building. That's what it was. In the building, there was a Shulchan. There was a Menorah. There was an Aron HaKadosh. There was a table. There was a candelabra. And there was an ark. But was there really a table? Was there really a candelabra? Was there really an ark? No, there wasn't. There was no table. You can't translate the word Shulchan into English. The table is a table, but the Shulchan in the Mishkan in the Beis HaMikdash was not a table. It was a Shulchan. It was a whole other thing in Gansin. It was a completely different thing. It was something else altogether. It was a Shulchan of Kedusha, of tremendous transformation into something that wasn't here just in this physical world. It was something which was ethereal. It was something which was spiritual. We didn't have a candelabra in the Beis HaMikdash. We had a menorah. We didn't have an ark in the Beis HaMikdash. We had an Aron Kodesh. We didn't have a tabernacle. We had a Mishkan. It's not just a difference in words. It's a difference in approach and how we understand life. So Kodesh Baruch Hu said, I want to spend a lot of time in the Torah talking about the Mishkan, talking about the Big Day Kahuna, because you even have to understand that the life that you're living in this world today, and every single generation, every single year that you're living, is not just a simple life. You're living something above and beyond yourselves. You transform into something great. You're learning here in yeshiva, right? You're sitting by tables, you're sitting by shtenders. You're reading a book, you're not reading a book. You're learning something, like somebody's in college is learning a trade or learning some type of a field. You're not. You're sitting in a Beis Medrash. You're sitting in front of a shtender. You're sitting opening a Gemara. And you're not learning a book. This is not Bible classes. This is not just some type of a trade. This is the Kedusha of Gemara. This is Gemara. This is Paiskim. This is Havana. This is Yiddish life. This is what it's all about. That's what you are. That's what you're doing here. It's not just plain sitting in four walls in a place in Jerusalem learning. No. You're studying Torah. We've transformed what you're doing into something which is above and beyond and something which is truly great. That's one lesson of the Mishkan. I want to tell you another lesson of the Mishkan. If you ever think about it, in the Beis HaMikdash, when the Beis HaMikdash was around, all of Yiddish life revolved around the Beis HaMikdash. People used to bring karbanos for all sorts of things. For good things when they had a baby, and for things which were not so good when they didn't have Avera. They also brought karbanos for Nedavos, and there's a chiyuv to come to the Mishkan and to the Beis HaMikdash 3 times a year, every single year, every single adult male has to come to the Beis HaMikdash. The culture of Klal Yisrael revolved around the Mishkan, around the Beis HaMikdash. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants that the culture of Klal Yisrael, understand this please, the culture of Klal Yisrael should revolve around Torah, around Kedusha. That's what he wants. Culture is defined by what people spend their time talking about. People spend the time, their free time, talking about. I had a friend from Atlanta. He was never in Lakewood Yeshiva in his life. And he was a fighter ben Torah. But he came from a particular family, and he was never in Atlanta in his life. He did a shidduch with a family. His son married a girl from Lakewood. And he went to Lakewood the first time in his life for the Ufruf. And he came back to Atlanta, and I asked him how it was. So he said to me, fascinating, he said, you know, I was in Lakewood, and I was going to Mincha. And on my way to Mincha, I'm running to Mincha. It's about a block away from Yeshiva. I see these three fellows. They're standing on the street corner, and they're talking about politics out loud on the street before Mincha. And I was appalled. I mean, come on, guys, you got to go to Mincha. And you know what? You don't speak that loud and that animated about political things. And it just didn't seem right in the middle of the street. Then I got closer, and I hear one guy saying, the Rashba doesn't say like that. And the other fellow says, well, if you look at the Ramban inside, you'd see that I'm correct. And the third fellow was just listening to what they're saying. Both of them are saying, they're having this argument in the street. He says, now we understand what Lakewood is. The culture of the city is Torah. They're sitting there, standing on a street corner. He assumed they were talking about politics. They're speaking about a Rashba, a Ramban, and a Ritva. That's what they're talking about. That's the culture. When you get up in the morning, the first thing you think about is what you heard about in Shir yesterday, or what you were learning about at night. And the Torah encourages us, you go to sleep thinking about Torah, because when you go to sleep thinking about Torah, you'll be waking up about Torah. The whole beauty of Daf Yomi, the way Rav Meir Shapiro set it up, was that when two Yidden meet each other in a foreign city on a train, they could be up to the exact same daf, and instead of schmoozing about something else, Avada, naturally, they'll talk about Torah. They'll speak about the Gemara, they'll speak about whatever they're up to, they'll speak about the Taisvus. And that's the way it should be when two Bachrim from Yeshiva meet each other in the street. The question is, no, what did your Rebbe say in Shir yesterday? Tell me, what I missed something. Let me hear from you, or you see somebody else from another Yeshiva, what are you up to? That's the first question you should be asking. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants that the culture of Klal Yisrael should revolve around Torah, and that's what it was in the time of the Beis Hamikdash and the time of the Mishkan. The culture revolved around Karbonos, it revolved around the Kohen Gadol, revolved around Bezdin, it revolved around the Lishchas HaGazes. That's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants. Now we're in Galus, we can't have that any longer, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants that forever after, the culture of Klal Yisrael should revolve around Divrei Torah, around Divrei Kedusha. That's why Hashem spent so much time telling us about the Mishkan, because it's a central part of Klal Yisrael. I want to tell you yet one other thing, if I could. I'm a little hesitant to say stories. I'll tell you why. Because when we say stories about Gedolei Yisrael, we tend to think that a Gadol is defined by the stories that we hear. And he's really not. A Gadol Yisrael is a Yid that has worked very, very hard to become who he was and to become the person that you hear about in the story. But his life is not a story. His life is working on his midas, working on his avodas Hashem, working on his tefillah, learning, spending very, very many nights learning Torah and trying to get it right and trying to understand it very well. That's what a Gadol Yisrael is. Not just a story. So I'm a little bit hesitant to tell you about stories, but I'm going to tell you a story anyway. And the reason I say this story is because it has a lot to do with the Mishkan, and it has a lot to do with, actually, myself. Not that I'm a Gadol Yisrael, not that I'm myself. See, I think that one of the reasons why HaKadosh Baruch Hu spent a lot of time talking about the Mishkan is because Hashem wants us to reflect about what the Mishkan stands for. Every single day in the Mishkan and in the Beis Hamikdash afterwards, there were tremendous nisim. There was a fire that came down from heaven and burnt up the karbanos. There were, the Mara relates, 10 nisim that occurred in the Beis Hamikdash on a daily basis. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to look at the Mishkan and say, wow, there were tremendous nisim that occurred. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the master of the world. The physical world is a nisim HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and I'll prove it to you. Thousands and thousands of years, thousands and thousands of generations, or I shouldn't say thousands, hundreds of generations, during the Mishkan, during the first Beis Hamikdash, during the second Beis Hamikdash, there were nisim that were done in the Beis Hamikdash on a steady basis. And people have to reflect on that. I bring this out to tell you this, that besides the transformation that a Yid is required to do in his life to make things into, from mundane things into Kaddishtika things, a person also has to be a Yid who lives in principles. It means there were certain principles that were denoted in the Mishkan and in the Beis Hamikdash, and these were embodied in the nisim that happened every single day. There were certain things that are immutable, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu created us, and Hashem created us to be able to serve Him, and there were mitzvahs in the Torah that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave to us, and these mitzvahs are immutable. And we have to put into our hearts that certain principles, we have to carve into our hearts that no matter what happens, we're going to keep these principles, and they're going to be unchanging. Today, I went to Harazesim. I was by the kever of my father, Olav Shalom, and the kever of my grandfather, Zechayna Levracha. I want to tell you a story about a very principled person, not even my great-grandfather. It's a very well-known story, but I suppose many of you might have heard it already, but I think it's probably worthwhile to hear it from an einikol of the person to whom it happened. My great-grandfather was named Rabbi Yosef Yitzchok Parnas, and he was born in a little small city in Galicia called Dikla, and he went to America at the advice of his Rebbe, Moshe Dumbrava. And in America, he was a big Talmud Chacham, and he was a tzaddik, a very big tzaddik. But he had a lot of difficulties finding a job in 1908 in America because he wouldn't work on Shabbos. So whenever he got a job as in a tailor shop, he would work Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And the boss, well, he would tell the boss, listen, I'm sorry, I can't come in on Shabbos because I keep Shabbos. And the bosses, unfortunately, many of them were often Jewish, would say to him, listen, if you can't come in on Shabbos, don't bother coming in on Monday. Sunday's the day off here, not Shabbos. Shabbos is not a day off. Well, he worked for a number of years in the sweatshops in Borough Park, in the Lower East Side. And he scrounged a little bit of money, brought over his family in between. And eventually, every single sweatshop in the Lower East Side got to know him. They knew that this Yid Parnas is not going to work on Shabbos. So when he applied to a job on a weekly basis in certain places, they would right away reject him and say, we know you don't work on Shabbos, I'm interested in having you. Well, they hear you. It was actually the middle of February, and it was in the early 1900s, and it was a very, very snowy day, similar to what we experienced on Friday, I imagine. And as my father will show, my uncles told me the story, that he couldn't find a job, and he had no money whatsoever. So the landlord came. They lived on a fourth floor walk-up, cold water flat, they used to call it. The landlord came, and he said, listen, if you're not going to pay your rent, out you have to go. So he took the family of 9 children, and he threw them out in the street, and they were there in New York in the early 1900s with a few bits of furniture that they had, and these 9 children are sitting there on a street with my grandfather, great-grandfather and his wife. There were no help organizations in those days. There was no Social Security. There was nothing from the government and nothing from any Jewish organization. It was very simple. If you worked, you lived. If you didn't work, you died. It was very simple. And my great-grandfather had no money. The superintendent of a building, actually the building that they were thrown out of, came to him and said, listen, I can't offer you a job. What I could offer, I can't offer you an apartment. You were thrown out. But if you want to come downstairs into the coal cellar, where they used to heat buildings in those days with coal, not with oil, you could live in the coal cellar, at least to be out of the cold, at least to be a little bit warm for you. So my great-grandfather thanked him and went downstairs with my bubby and the family. And they lived for a number of weeks in the coal cellar. His children peddled matches and apples on the street in order to make a few cents, but they really had almost nothing. They were living in a coal cellar, living barely on starvation diet, and had nothing at all. One day, his son, my grandfather, was playing with his siblings in the street, and they were just playing. And this Yid walks by, and of course they're talking in Yiddish. That was their language, they're talking in Yiddish. And a Yid walks by, and he listens to them talk, and he says in Yiddish, Zestuch, the Afila de Schwarzes in New York can't read in Yiddish. It means even the blacks in New York know how to speak Yiddish. So my grandfather and my uncles turned to him and said, Was heißt doch, was sind die Schwarzes, was sind die Yiddish Kind? What are you talking about? We're not Schwarzes, we're Jewish kids. So he looked at him, he was taken aback. He says, so why are you so black like this? He said, because we live in the coal cellar. He says, why do you live in the coal cellar? Your father's sick, you can't get a job. No, our father's healthy. So why can't he get a job? He said, my father won't work on Shabbos. If he won't work on Shabbos, we have no money. So this fellow says, I can't believe this. In today's day and age, a fellow is going to subject his family to live in a coal cellar, and he's not going to work on Shabbos. Doesn't make any sense. I want to see him. Take me to him. So this fellow goes downstairs with the kids, and he sees my great-grandfather, and he's learning by a sefer, the little light from the coal furnace. He's learning. And he says to him, tell me, why can't you get a job? He said, I'd love to get a job. This conversation is occurring in Yiddish, obviously. I'd love to get a job. I can't get a job. Why not? Because I can't get a job. Will they let me keep Shabbos? So the fellow says, you know what? He took Rachmanis and them. He saw the family had nothing. He said, I'll give you $500. You take that money, and you'll go and you'll get yourself an apartment. Let me explain to you something. In those days, in the early 1900s, the entire apartment building, they could have bought it for $3,000. You could have put a $500 down payment on the apartment building and used the rent money to live comfortably for the rest of his life. That's what he could have done, an entire apartment building. $500 would have gotten an entire house. So my great-grandfather asked the man, let me ask you something, he said. He looked at him, he said, tell me, do you keep Shabbos yourself? So the fellow said, no. So my grandfather said, listen, just wait for a moment. He went to the corner of the coal cellar, and he spoke to my great-grandmother. He said, listen, you know I have a principle that I don't take any money, I'm not nana from anybody, who doesn't keep Shabbos. I won't take any money, his vernacular was, basenish kosher fadint. I won't take any money that was not kosher earned. But, you know, we're in such a difficult situation, would you want me to take this money, we'll get out of this coal cellar? So she said, no, keep your principle. So she kept her, he went back to him and he said, listen, I appreciate the offer, but I cannot take your money. I can't take your money because you didn't earn it in a kosher fashion. So the man was furious and he left. He went back home to his wife and he said to her, sweetheart, you won't believe what happened today. I met a meshugana guy. I met a guy, his kids were so black with cold, they had no shower, they have no place to live, they have no food, they have no clothing. They're sitting there in a coal cellar and I took Rachmanis and then I offered to give them money, $500, offered to give it to them, and they wouldn't take it because I work on Shabbos. And he's laughing at them. And he looks at his wife, and his wife begins to cry. He says, why are you crying? She says, do you remember when we first came to America, and we kept Shabbos too, and we couldn't get a job, and we promised ourselves that you would begin to work on Shabbos, but as soon as we had enough money, you would go back and you would stop working on Shabbos. And now we've sunk so low that Kosher Eden won't even touch our money. That's how low we've sunk. And this man began to cry too. And they made up, from that moment on, was they going to keep Shabbos. The man went back to my great-grandfather in the coal cellar, and he said to him, if I keep Shabbos and I earn money kosher, will you take my money? And my great-grandfather said, yes. If you take your earn kosher money, I will take it. And the man came back and gave my father, my great-grandfather, that same $500. My great-grandfather opened up the very first Hasidish Shtibel in Borough Park, the very first men's mikveh in Borough Park, which is still in existence today, 5510 16th Avenue. This Yid became a chassid of my great-grandfather. This Yid became a full Baal Tshuva. His name was Biston. He has family in Williamsburg. He has Chabad family. His family all over America has a fascinating thing, that the Bistons, their entire family, from start to finish, top to bottom, every single one of them are Shomer Shabbos. And in my great-grandfather's family, Baruch Hashem Kimat, every single one of his descendants is also Shomer Shabbos, which is unusual for families that came to America in the early 1900s. HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells us, you take a look at the lessons of the Mishkan. It was a real thing. Puk Chazir A. There were Nisim that occurred every single day. There were principles that I'm transmitting to you. Keep those principles. Etch them in your heart and come whatever may be, do not give up on those principles and you will have tremendous haslacha in life. And I wish you and this yeshiva phenomenal haslacha. Etch the principles of Torah and the yeshiva in your mind, etch them there forever, and no matter what happens, whichever situation you find yourself in, keep them with you, and all of you Beis Hashem will have tremendous haslacha. Thank you. Good. Rosemary.